Welcome to UEG Podcast, where we talk about scientific discoveries, educational insights, and professional development within the world of digestive health. Whether you're a clinician, researcher, or just passionate about GI content, this is the podcast for you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Agla, and I'm the host of UEG Talks, educational and hopefully fun dive into GI world and beyond. We're very happy to have you with us for another exciting episode. So today we're having a really cool flashback to the summer, European Pancreatic Lab Conference in Dusseldorf. There we had the fortune to catch the pancreas master extraordinaire, continent-jumping Italian surgeon currently running surgical oncology division in Denver, Colorado, and the chief of the highly anticipated pan-continental guidelines on pancreatic cystic neoplasms, Professor Marco Del Chiaro. Enjoy the moments from the summer. So Marco, you're now leading this global massive effort into new guidelines for pancreatic cystic neoplasms. Why the hell do we need it? Because the Kyoto guidelines just were published on IPMN. There are new American guidelines. Okay, the European are quite old. They need an update. But why do we need global ones?
Well, thank you. First of all, this is a very interesting question. Number one. The Kyoto guidelines include only IPMNs. Those guidelines try to give guidance for all kinds of cystic tumor of the pancreas. That's one difference. Also, I think that one of the problems that we face in the past has been having so many different guidelines. And it's even true that, several of those are not so different. But we are talking here about an extremely complex group of diseases to treat, even for experts. And having around guidelines with sometimes small difference, sometimes bigger difference, I think create a lot of confusion, or at least let's say it doesn't facilitate so much the work of our colleagues, especially the one that maybe they are on dealing every day with tumor patients. So I think trying to have a common ground, let's say designing together the rules of the game, is probably better than just continuing to write in different guidelines.
Okay, so we need a global one, but how does it translate into different because these are like three continents, right? Different populations, different traditions, different technology, different availability of the tools diagnostic. How does it combine all these aspects in utilizing those guidelines?
Yeah, you're completely right. I think one of the major challenges, more than tradition, you know, our goal is to create global guidelines that are trying to homogenize diagnosis, treatment, management of those patients. But I agree with you that probably there will be problem of applicability based, for example, on availability of resources. And that's, of course, is a problem that need to be addressed. What I want to try to underline here is that what we want to offer is what is the best of the evidence, which probably is not extremely high. We don't have prospective randomized trial in this topic, but what is the best level of evidence to treat those patients? Obviously, the guidelines are not the law. And I would not be surprised or I would not be even disappointed if there are people that feel that sometimes they cannot be adherent completely to the guideline. At the end, the decision remains a doctor decision, patient decision. But we want to try to offer the best we have on evidence on managing this patient. And that's it. And then, of course, clearly, if there are situations in which you cannot fulfill completely those criteria, you can't. But I think trying to design the best of the evidence is a duty that we should try to complete.
Yeah, I think you touched on the point that every guideline has a disclaimer at the bottom that this does not substitute your thinking capabilities.
But it's true, because probably there are no guidelines that can take in consideration every single aspect of the patient care, the patient characteristics, or the cystic characteristic. It's very difficult to copy and paste a guideline in a person.
Definitely.
And so I think this is not just a legal statement. I think it's the truth. And I think that every doctor at the end has the full responsibility to discuss with the patient wherever is needed. And the patient has the full right to say, I agree, I disagree, I want to have a second opinion, a third opinion. So again, no one of us has the truth, especially in argument with low evidence. Trying to offer the best we can to guide people, I think, is a good initiative.
What do you think about the guidelines that include the second and third best options? If A is not available, let's do B. It's of lower quality.
Well, you know, so here you touch a point. There are, I think, choices when you decide to draw a project. And I think when you go through a quite rigorous evidence-based methodology, I think it's extremely important that you remain very aligned with this methodology. You know, there are many guidelines that are more expert opinion. And I have to tell you, sometimes they're good because I'm not undermining the value of any of those. Once we decide to do this choice, we did because you mentioned before, and I agree with you, that there are very different practice across the world, sometimes even in the same continent, that more related to the practice than really to the
tradition.
Evidence. And then it becomes really very difficult to put together. If you want to really do with people across the world, putting together people with different practice, different beliefs, right? Unless you really have a common ground, which is, I mean, a methodology. And that's, I think, is what we try to do here.
But if you're sticking to great, where does belief come? And where is the dispute then? If it's black and white, if it's great.
Well, first of all, yes. Well, you're right. But take in mind that many of the questions will probably have a relatively moderate or low level of evidence because we don't have prospective randomized trial, right? So, I mean, that's, I believe, and again, I don't have the version, the final version of the guidelines, so I'm just guessing, but I believe that would be very difficult to find a super high level of evidence in many aspects. And then the part of the process will be the expert vote on the agreement on the guy, on the single point. That's, I think, is an intriguing part because then, I mean, it's adding probably what you are telling now. So what is the opinion of people that are expert on the statement that the same group of people basically made, right? And this, I think, is very, very important.
But it's so peculiar because the statement comes from the evidence and evidence is graded, the risk of bias is assessed. So
it is very, true. But that's, I mean, tell you somehow what is the practice that maybe could be changed. But once we have enough level of evidence to say, okay, that's, I mean, need to go in another direction. But the reality is that building evidence takes time. You know, when we speak about, now let me speak about the more common cystic lesion, so the IPMNs. I mean, it's a relatively new disease.
20 years?
Correct. So what I'm saying is that, and it's a very difficult disease to randomize because of the clinical history, right? You have a rare number of events and you have a long progression time. So whenever you want to do a prospective study, a randomized trial, I mean, it's extremely difficult to have a statistical power to really demonstrate something. That's why I'm not saying we will not do it. I'm sure we will, but I'm not sure I will be in a podcast at the time when you have a strong evidence in this topic.
Who has the patience to see the development, the natural history?
Well, that's one problem. I think we can have the patience, but we need the time. And that's, I mean, we cannot buy. We need to wait.
Okay, we'll see you then. Let's meet in 10 years and see where this is at. So you already touched upon one thing, that there are not many randomized controlled trials. I mean, surveillance, there are some, like what to do. But at least the European 2018 consensus was based mostly on surgical cases. And these are, In essence, the people who already have high-risk stigmata or worrisome features that were collected for surgical route. And now we have accumulating evidence on population-based cohort studies of observation. So you cannot disclose, this is okay, but do you have the feeling that the guidelines will go into more liberal route?
I have the feeling that everything we add to our knowledge will be part of the guideline. And actually, I'm sure, because that's the methodology we use it. So everything will be included and weighted in every kind of answer we give to the guideline. I want to add you one thing. This is part of the issue that we discussed before. There are different kind of bias that you can, you know, identify in different kind of study. For sure, the surgical series has bias. You're right. It's a selected population of patients. They have also an advantage. You have an histology. So whenever you have a population, a cohort of people you follow over time, there are three major problems as well. One problem, how many of those you think are IPMN? We have studies showing that the diagnostic error are 20-30% of patients we see with cystic fusion. Those studies are maybe a little bit dated, maybe today is a little bit lower, but still is significant, I'm sure about that. Number two, are you sure that, you know, one patient that you see for 5 years will not develop something in 10 years?
I'm never sure.
And exactly. So the follow-up of those study, some of those studies, quite short if you consider the clinical history of cystic lesion. And I go to the last and third point that I want to discuss. I think, you know, even in terms of sample population, which is the ideal number to check the number of events in a disease that apparently has an incredible prevalence. And then you see study maybe including a few hundreds of patients, which compared to the prevalence in the population, if the prospective study from Germany is true, represent really an extremely small sample size. Now, saying that, is clear that if the prevalence is very high and we have incidence of pancreas cancer quite low, we know that very minority of those patients would develop cancer, right? So that's, I mean, I think is probably one of the few things I personally think that is quite clear. But what I'm saying is that I agree with you. Having more of this observational study is extremely important, but that doesn't cut some of the important bias that we have in every study regarding pancreatic cyst and especially APMN. At least this is my personal opinion.
Now, a quick message from UEG. Want to boost your gastro knowledge? Then Gutflix is the place to be. Gutflix is an interactive learning platform for GI professionals. Get access to expert-led online courses, UEG Week recordings, mistakes in articles, and more. Best of all, Gutflix is free. Log on today at gutflix.eu.
Okay, then what's your... Now, you touched about the increased risk after 10 years. There's accumulating evidence on discontinuation on small, stable cysts. But we know that with time, the risk increases. It's time-based risk increase. So how can we discontinue surveillance after 5 years?
We have an incredible team of some of the most expert in this field for the global guideline that is working on this topic. I'm sure they will give us a very good answer.
So now that we know that the guidelines are based on the evidence that we have, also on what we extrapolate from it and what we think or we believe, not even the data, actually black or white. So, okay, we have a consensus, we agree, but how does it translate into everyday practice? I think the study from your run guidelines on mucinous neoplasm did a systematic review and found that actual risk of malignancy is much smaller than it was previously detected, and it's like 16%. But what do you do with those 16% and a patient when the counterpart is a Whipple, most probably, with one third of people having severe complications?
So this is a very intriguing question. And I think that this question is following, you know, is actually explaining very well how I think creating guideline, but creating even working group is so important for making the next guideline even better. So I don't know if you know the full story and, you know, I speak in my best knowledge, maybe I'm wrong in that, but I think the very first guideline in which we recommended to do not resect every MCN were the first European guideline of 2013. Expert opinion guidelines, so basically it was not really an evidence-based process, in which basically we told, well, let's treat them like IPMN. At that time, if you remember, dimension was one of the most important criteria. Actually, we went to 4 instead than 3, both for IPMN and MCN. That has been probably the first recommendation saying we don't need to resect all MCN. Based on a few data in literature, well, some data in literature. Since then, we continue to work together, creating more evidence. In the 2018, that has been again confirmed by the 2018 European evidence-based at this time, guideline on cystic tumor. And again, some of us still continue to investigate the topic and trying to give more evidence. Now, MCN we know is rare. So clearly, I mean, they are all retrospective series. And even if we say large, probably are not large enough to say really we are sure 100%. Complication-wise, and, cost benefit. I think that, so first of all, majority of the MCN is not a weak polycystic because they're most normally female, okay. Body and tail of the pancreas. Normally today they are minimally invasive in many cases. But I think that, even if probably for many people of my generation still remains sometimes strange to recommend surveillance because, for many years you've been teaching to remove all of them. We have now quite a lot of data, again, not with strong evidence, but supporting the fact most of these patients, if you follow at least up to 4 centimeters without any radiological concern and feature, is quite safe. So I think we are learning and we are moving our target accordingly with the new insight that we have. One of the things that I hope and I really think would be probably one of the best things we can do in a new guideline, we put together more than 100 experts across the world, several scientific societies. I think at the end of the guideline, we should consider the end of the guideline the beginning of making this group continuing collaborating together and trying to understand which are the points with less evidence and invest together and create a higher evidence for the next guideline.
Okay, so you're foolproofing your future. Do you have a plan for an update already?
No, and I think you need to update when it's time to update. There is no expiring date. And, I think I'm moving fast. There are many areas in medicine that are changing, and maybe in the next year will give us much more insight on what we are doing, much more precise.
Okay.
So, we need to keep eyes open, and whenever we feel there is something that we need to improve, that will be the time.
Do you think there will be biomarkers coming in the, let's say, future 5 years?
I think we are entering in this era, and we're trying to enter in this era. I think that the future hopefully will be more and more based on, on something measurable that give us, stratify for us the risk. I think so far, speaking about practice, the large part of the practice is based on quite traditional imaging and sampling. There are some new tests that are, there. Let's see how they will perform. But I'm pretty sure that in the near future, we'll have more and more and even simpler, right? The best would be take a blood test and say, okay, that's your risk profile. That's what you have.
But it's quite scary if you know your risk profile. It's like knowing when you are going to die.
Or maybe if you need an operation to avoid to die or not.
True. But if you know all the risks that you have, you might opt for pancreatectomy if you know that you have a possibility.
Well, if you really have a very trustable test, then you can argue that, you can really pre-treat something before, you risk to be too late. The problem is that today we don't know. I want to be provocative in this idea. Today, ideally when you do an operation for an IPMN, let's say, you hope that, probably the best timing is getting a patient at the level of high-grade dysplasia. We know it's very difficult because at that point, there is quite high risk that you get even the patient in cancer, which is a completely different situation, right? But whenever you have even a patient with low-grade dysplasia, some of those patients may remain low-grade dysplasia all life. Some of those patients may become cancer. You don't really know, right?
There's no stratification.
And I still believe that when you see some concerning feature, that normally associated with the risk of cancer, probably even if the histology is not there yet, that there is a good risk that this patient probably will go there. So I think even the way we try to measure our performance today is very primitive, if you want to use this term, in the sense that really no one of us knows, especially at the very beginning, what would be the destiny of this cyst. We know that when it's cancer,
it's too late.
Yeah. But all the rest remains still an area where we argue, but we don't really have proof in which direction would be one or the other. So I think there is where I think the future potentially could be very useful in saying, okay, you have a cyst and we know 98% that this cyst 10 years from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, that's probably, we cannot really state completely, but you have a huge chance would become a cancer. Then, you don't have so many problems to say to the patient, okay, I think probably it's better to remove. But the patient can say, no, I want to wait until, I see again. Patient choice. But I think, I think this really would be nice to understand who need to go one way, can go another. Coming back to your previous question, that's probably will be the moment even in which very safely, we can say, okay, this patient doesn't need any follow-up, right? Or this patient needs a follow-up. Or, no, this patient better to go directly to surgery. That's probably will be really something based on something more concrete. Today is a statistical risk that we are analyzing on
it's
some
an
data.
Average, that an average person. Exactly. But exactly. Also, here's where the belief comes in. I mean, if you have a pancreas, you have a risk for cancer.
Oh, yeah,
and
sure.
Then if you have a cystic neoplasm, the risk is diverse, but it's for average person. And how can you deal with that risk? You don't know.
I think we'll discuss about that for the next guideline.
Okay. I think then this is a good point to end. And there's a promise for meeting in 10 years?
Well, let's meet again when the guideline will be out so we can maybe discuss more about the detail.
Okay, because you're very sparse with information. We really wanted a sneak peek, but okay.
Well, when they're published, I will be more clear with the information.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much, Marco. It was incredible. Thank you for writing this guideline that we are so keen to see the results of.
Thank you very much.
See you in after the publishing then.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to UEG Podcast. We hope you've found some new ideas, insights, and inspiration to take with you. Don't forget to subscribe, and if you like our content, please leave us a review and share our podcast with your colleagues.